get an attack where Russians will hit NATO forces, and we will find ourselves in the midst of a hot war.
Sure. Well, since our guest there is from Stockholm, Sweden, I'd like to ask you, in terms of the application made by Sweden and Finland, and what your thoughts are about their desire and eagerness to join NATO.
Of Sweden, honestly, it's an old desire. Maybe it was pushed up by the war now between Russia and Ukraine, but this desire existed, and there were lots of voices calling to join NATO, but that was not really priority in Sweden. We know Sweden did not get involved in any war since more than 200 years, since 1814, did not get involved in any war. So despite that, Sweden was somehow motivated to go to the NATO since, especially after the end of the Cold War, 1990 of last century. So this is all desire. But now I estimate it somehow came with rush. This step came with rush. Sweden would better to wait at least until the end of this year, because until today we do not know what is the limit of the escalation. Shall Russian side use a nuclear as threatened with, or it will limit its military action and military operation on what's running on the ground. Employing the pressures against a nuclear power must be managed differently, in my opinion. Russia is a nuclear power. You cannot put it under such pressure. So that's why we did not know the escalation will arrive to where. This right. is the point for the moment.
Fred Weir from Moscow, journalist and political commentator. Thank you. And thank you, Mahmoud Rafat, president at the European Institute for International Law and International Relations from Stockholm. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mika Vitavoy and the team, it's goodbye.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You're listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Shiraz Hossein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom and a PhD in philosophy.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program, The Key, here at IRIB English Radio. Thank you for joining us here today. Today on The Key, we're going to be looking at a very significant and important question. And that question is about the meaning of the word zuhud or asceticism. You know, asceticism or zuhud is one of the important and significant Islamic virtues. And it has been encouraged in the Hadith and in the Holy Quran. And this asceticism or zuhud is kind of tied up to a more general virtue, a more central virtue, and that is the renunciation of the world, right? And the relinquishment of the love of the world. You know, there's a hadith, a famous hadith, which says that hubbu dunya ra'su kulli khata'in. Love of the world is the head or the cause or the root of all evil, right? So this renunciation of the world or the love of the world, right, it's manifested in various ways. One of the ways that it's manifested is zuhud or asceticism, you know? So this is why it's so significant. But unfortunately, there is a lot of ambiguity and misunderstanding regarding the meaning of this word. And people go to extremes sometimes, at least maybe not in our times, but in the past, a lot of people have gone to extremes. And they have adopted an incorrect version of zuhud and asceticism. So we see certain Sufis, right, who practiced an extreme form of zuhud by, for example, going and living in the mountains, and never getting married, never having children. Sometimes a lot of them would even suffice themselves with a walnut or a date, right? Every day. And it's interesting to note that a lot of times this led them to acquire certain spiritual, abilities, right? And these have been recorded and have in the annals of history, and there's no denying them. But the question that we want to ask today is not whether that this extreme form of asceticism, does it lead to somebody gaining a certain spiritual power and, ability. Rather, we want to say, within the context of Islam in general, is this something virtuous or not? Right? What is the virtuous zuhd or asceticism in Islam? Fortunately, this has been alluded to in the Hadith and in the Quran. When we look at the Hadith and the Quran, we see that the zuhd, which is virtuous in Islam and is Islamic in nature, is the one which is an action of the heart. It doesn't imply foregoing the world, practically foregoing the world, not having anything to do with the world, right? Rather, it implies not attaching one's heart to the world, right? Let's look at a hadith from Imam Ali alayhi salam where he kind of alludes to this meaning of zuhd. Imam Ali said, "Those who restrain themselves from worldly pleasures are such." So the actual word that Imam Ali used is "azahidina fi dunya," are such that their hearts are weeping, though outwardly they may laugh. Thank you for joining us here on The Key. We were looking at the meaning of zuhd in the words of the Aima and Imam Ali alayhi salam. Until next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Shiraz Hussein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom and a PhD in philosophy on the program The Key on IRIB English Radio.
You can also send your questions to English Radio at irib.ir.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Eruba Shavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
The European Commission is asking EU member states to reduce demand for gas by 15% until spring. For now, this is just a request, but the Commission warns it might well become a demand.
The 15% are aspirational. It's a voluntary goal. It's aspirational. And in case that we are in an emergency, then the target becomes binding.
The EU claims it's concerned that Russia will cut off all gas supplies in retaliation for sanctions imposed by the West over the war in Ukraine.
Shortfalls will not just affect the countries where the shortfalls happen. They will affect every single member state because they will have serious consequences on our economy. And nobody can escape that consequence.
The truth is, Russia has fulfilled all its energy supply contracts to the EU and vows to continue doing so. Some analysts believe the US and its transnational companies are behind the hysteria because they want to take business from Russia's Gazprom Energy Corporation.
The whole rhetoric today is based on imaginary threat, which was never confirmed by Russian authorities, because on contrary, Russian authorities said on many occasions, and including the President Putin, that Gazprom will honour their contracts.
Since Russia's so-called special military operation was launched in Ukraine last February, the EU has been importing large amounts of liquefied natural gas from the United States. It's an expensive process. The bloc is also signing contracts with countries in Africa and the Middle East. During a technical briefing here for journalists, officials confirmed to me there has been no contact with Iran on increasing EU energy supplies, despite the Islamic Republic having enormous oil and gas reserves. In this regard, analysts say the EU continues to bow to US pressure, and it's ordinary citizens who are paying the price for that. Jerome Hughes at the European Commission, Brussels.
You don't have to be a financial expert to know your pound just isn't going as far. The price of everything has gone up. Living in the UK has become more expensive.
I've had to cut down on a lot of stuff. I can do shopping only maybe once, twice a month because finances are not that great. See, most money goes on bills, petrol, to get the kids to school, come back and, you know, make sure the house is in order because obviously the kids have to eat.
We've seen a dramatic increase in it whereby we could go and spend X amount and that would be for 7 days. We're now going, actually, that's not even covering the whole week now.
The things contributing to the high rate of inflation, soaring energy, fuel and food prices, driven by a number of factors.
Those causes are very often related to Ukraine and Putin and the war, because what we know is that has pushed up gas and electricity prices. They're also transport costs have been going up because of logistical problems following the coronavirus. Then, of course, we've got the problem of Brexit.
And the worst is yet to come. Britain's central bank has warned price rises could hit 11% later this year, but will come down in the year after. Experts say the UK could be at risk of recession.
The Bank of England's got it wrong as usual. So it will come down, but it will be much more persistent than anybody is anticipating. And to get it back down to 2% could take at least 3 years, not two, not one. And it's going to take a long time, actually, because it's now embedded in the system. And people will want to catch up. You see, the public sector, they're going to take a big real wage cut this year, probably, but they're not going to tolerate that the following year.
The government says one way to contain inflation is to suppress wages. Prices are going up, but incomes are not keeping up. That has meant sweeping rail strikes over demands for higher pay. Some public sector workers, such as teachers and medics, have received a pay rise, but below the inflation rate.
These are tough times for everybody, but it's those on the lowest incomes who are feeling the pinch. According to one study, more than 4 million, that's one in six British households, are worse off now than they were last year, a number that could change come the cold season. Saeed Purizab, London.
Illegal and politically motivated. That's how angry protesters describe a Swedish court ruling sentencing Iranian national Hamid Nouri of life in jail over participating in killing imprisoned dissidents. Nouri is a former judiciary staff who has been convicted by the Stockholm District Court on July 14th of taking part in the 1988 execution of members of the anti-Iran terror group Mojahedin-e-Khalq organization, while he served as an assistant to the deputy prosecutor at the Gohardasht prison outside the Iranian city of Karaj. Protesters here warn that the Swedish verdict has sent negative signals to Iranians.
We gathered outside the Swedish embassy today to demand an end to Sweden's circus trial of Hamid Nouri.
Sweden has no jurisdiction to rule on a case that's considered a domestic issue in Iran. Besides, all of the witnesses who testified against Mr. Nouri were members of a terror group and have never seen Nouri in person in Iran.
The accusations were leveled against Nouri by members of the Mojahedin-e-Khalq terror group, or MKO. Protesters here say the MKO itself has committed countless war crimes, from aiding former Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein in the 1980s Iran-Iraq War to the serial killings of Iranian statesmen and civilians in the early years after the 1979 Islamic Revolution. The MKO was on the U.S. and EU's blacklist of terrorist organizations before both countries delisted the group in 2012 and 2009, respectively.
The MKO have the blood of at least 12,000 Iranians on their hands. They have no position amongst Iranians, and we call them the hypocrites here in Iran. So I want to tell the Swedish prosecutor that a ruling is tantamount to approving the crimes committed by MKO terrorists against Iranians.
Iran says Hamid Nouri has for the past 32 months been kept in abysmal conditions in a solitary confinement in Sweden. Hamid Nouri was arrested upon arrival in Sweden at Stockholm Airport in 2019 and was immediately imprisoned. A life sentence in Sweden generally means a minimum of 20 to 25 years in prison. Nouri can appeal the verdict.
Protesters here called the whole shebang as a political game aimed at smearing the Islamic Republic's justice system. They described the Swedish ruling as rabble-rousing, which whitewashes terrorism and gives a green light to the ill intentions of the MKO against Iranians. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Iran's flagship carrier, Iranair, has returned to Rome from July 14. A new deal recently signed between Iranian and Italian aviation authorities has revived the route connecting Tehran and Italy's capital, Rome. The deal is a revised version of previous aviation cooperation agreement, which stresses the importance of increased flights between the two countries to help boost economic ties and tourism.
Io già andai in Iran 20 anni fa.
I visited Iran 20 years ago, and I've been thrilled about that trip. I'm going again with a group of friends in September, and we're all very excited.
There has certainly been a more intense dialogue between Italy and Iran lately, and this is extremely positive. Having said that, we are still facing enormous difficulties due to the sanctions. However, we are confident that more European routes will be added by Iran Air in the future.
Iranair, which has been flying to Italy for 55 years, also operates flights to the business-focused city of Milan in the north of the country. Aviation ties between Iran and Italy took a hit in 2018 when the US unilaterally withdrew from the 2015 deal known as the JCPOA. Washington's withdrawal was followed by a wave of anti-Iran sanctions by the US.
I hope this resumption of the Tehran-Rome route will bode well for another resumption, that of the JCPOA, from which the U.S. unilaterally withdrew in 2018. It would be really important for tourism and commerce that flight connections between Iranian and European cities are established.
Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian traveled to Rome last week to meet his Italian counterpart and discuss the latest geopolitical developments across the globe. During that visit, Iran's top diplomat also met with tens of Italian industrialists and businessmen who showed a strong interest in cooperating with Tehran. Max Civili, Rome.
As temperatures in Britain soar, the race for the next Conservative Party leader is also heating up. Following further eliminations, now only three candidates remain. On Monday, Tom Tugendhat was eliminated during the third round vote, whilst Kemi Badenoch went out in the fourth. Rishi Sunak remains in the lead. Penny Mordaunt is close in second place, followed by Liz Truss. However, as the fight intensifies, things are turning bitter, with attacks on policy, along with accusations of ideological treachery, leading to candidates refusing to appear on future televised debates. Pundits believe the divisive race has exposed deep-rooted splits in the ruling party at a time when Britain faces numerous economic crises.
A senior Conservative journalist said to me that he found the entire leadership campaign wholly depressing. He thinks that it's been a competition to be negative. He thinks it's a race to the bottom in terms of showing what's wrong with the others rather than what's right with themselves. And crucially, we see a party divided. It seems to me that the Conservatives are going through an identity crisis, perhaps partly caused by Boris Johnson, who was a populist, without a very clear philosophy. Now, the next leader has to refocus the Conservatives on its more traditional values.
There can be little doubt in Rishi Sunak achieving a place in the final round, as he only requires five more supporters in order to achieve that place. However, the real battle will be over who joins him in second place. Two candidates will last into the final round, and then, of course, it goes to the votes from the Tory party membership to decide who the next leader of the party, and therefore the country, will be. Robert Carter, London.
During a joint press conference, which followed the latest round of their Astana process talks, Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi welcomed the Russian and Turkish presidents, along with their accompanying delegations, to the summit. Raisi stressed the need to protect the territorial integrity and sovereignty of Syria, as well as the importance of the fight against terrorism.
Discussions focused on the sovereignty of Syria and the territorial integrity of the country, emphasizing that the Syrian government must rule over all parts of the country and that the presence of Americans on the eastern banks of the Euphrates is not acceptable and they must withdraw and all parts of the country must be governed by the legitimate government. We all emphasize that we should combat terrorism and there is the need to do so and there is also a need for cooperation among all states. Today, terrorist currents have jeopardized the security of the region. The all-out fight against terrorism by the Islamic Republic of Iran was a successful experience. I commemorate Lieutenant General Soleimani as the icon of resistance and combating terrorism. All countries have fought against terrorism, but today there are concerns about the presence of terrorists in Syria. So there is a need for firm results to be achieved by all states that participate in the fight against terrorism.
Russian President Vladimir Putin echoed similar remarks and highlighted the importance of the Astana process.
We agreed. In order to normalize the situation in Syria, all three countries have agreed that full settlement of the conflict is only possible through political means and holding talks based on UNSC Resolution 2254, and while observing the basic principle of sovereignty and territorial integrity and unity of Syria. All these principles must be respected and the future of Syria must be dictated by its own people and nothing should be dictated from the outside.
Putin added that all sides have called for the continuation of the fight against terrorism and extremism so that such threats will be eliminated. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan, while echoing the remarks made by his counterparts, also pointed out the importance of finding a sustainable political solution to the Syrian situation.
The city of Severodonetsk lies mostly in ruins. It was the scene of some of the fiercest fighting between the two armies. It now resembles a post-apocalyptic wasteland. At a military base, a pro-Russian fighter pulls down a Ukrainian sign. What's left of the city is now in Russian hands. On the outskirts of town, a grain silo. Russia and Ukraine blame each other for bombing it. Now, that may well be one of the most tragic places that I've been to in this war, because millions of people around the world may well go hungry due to this conflict because of the huge amounts of grain that Ukraine exports in usual times around the world. For those people, it won't really matter whether it was Russia or Ukraine who committed this strike. Humanity is bombing its own food supplies. Unsurprisingly, few people remain in the city. Those that do are keen to tell of what they saw.
The Ukrainians knew where people lived. They drove around looking for people's houses. And when they fled, they occupied their houses and started firing. We live in that house, and they were firing from there for 3 weeks.
It wasn't all done by Russia. It was done by Ukraine. There are witnesses who saw tanks driving up and firing at houses, just like that.
While NATO and Ukraine blame Russia for the devastation, the strange truth is that everyone I spoke to here is more critical of Ukraine.
Ukraine acted in a sly way. They would bring a howitzer here, fire, and then leave. Then Russia would strike, and they would say Russia is bombing civilians. They were occupying kindergartens and would fire from there.
They made them sit in the basement and took over their flats. They put mortars on the roofs and fired. We don't know what Russia did. We didn't see them until we returned.
While Russia and Ukraine continue to blame each other for the devastation wrought by this conflict, there remains little appetite for peace. The longer this war goes on, the more of Ukraine will be destroyed, and the greater the threat to world food supplies and the global economy. Jaromír Severodonetsk.
EU Foreign Affairs ministers held their last scheduled meeting on Monday before taking a six-week summer break. Of course, proceedings were dominated by the war in Ukraine.
Ukraine needs more arms. We will provide them. The war will continue. We'll continue supporting. And that's why I have proposed the next tranche of the European Peace Facility, allocating 500 million more.
Josep Borrell has doubled down on criticism of sanctions against Russia and their impact on EU citizens. He has even written a blog on the subject. It's reported he's doing this because of growing disquiet amongst EU leaders regarding the harm sanctions are causing. Energy and food prices continue to rise in the EU, placing enormous pressure on citizens. Experts warn things could get worse.
We have seen over the last couple of months that there is disparity, there is disunity. There is already an exception for Hungary in terms of energy supply. And my worry is that as soon as the winter sets in, there might be a problem, and then we have to see how long the support for the sanctions will materialise.
Ordinary citizens are asking why we don't hear more about peace negotiations.
The price you pay now is out of control. Gas, oil, electricity, food. It's all gone crazy. We need to end the war.
As the West continues to pump billions of euro and dollars into Ukraine, the country's president, Volodymyr Zelensky, is sacking senior officials. Analysts say it shows the country remains corrupt at the highest levels. The European Commission will unveil much-anticipated plans on Wednesday designed to ensure the EU doesn't run out of gas this winter. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
The British capital is boiling with July temperatures rarely seen in the country. For some, it's business as usual, a chance to bask in it. For others, a cause for concern.
I would say climate changing. Every year, it's just getting hotter and hotter. In other countries like Dubai and Kuwait, that's 50, 60 degrees. That's normal nowadays.
Basically, we let it go like downhill for like 200 years, for example. And now we just, we're doing something wrong here, you know. But at least the realization is a first step. So hopefully they will take it more serious and start actually doing something.
With temperatures climbing up to 41 degrees Celsius over the next 2 days, the National Meteorological Service has issued its first ever red warning for exceptional heat for much of the country.
Britain is a country where people are used to complaining about the wet weather. Now this scorching heat is going to give them something else to gripe about. But it doesn't stop there. There's real concern about how these rising temperatures will impact the everyday life.
Metro passengers have been urged not to travel by train. Schools are only allowing early pickups after the government said they had to stay open and that people should be resilient enough to enjoy the sunshine. Climate activists are threatening more decisive action to perceived inaction by government and big business, similar to the Extinction Rebellion protest that shut down parts of central London a few years ago. The activists' frustration now confirmed by the UK's climate minister, Alok Sharma, who has accused some of the candidates running for prime minister of being lukewarm on achieving the country's net zero target. And this week, his plea for climate action as he addressed the Petersburg Climate Dialogue in Berlin.
I have to say, and I say this with all sincerity, that many of the commitments that we heard in Glasgow remain just that. They are still just words on a page. And you know, because you can see this around you, all the evidence tells us that time is running out.
Climate scientists say the next decade will be defined by greater weather extremes. But the fear is it'll also be shaped by humanity's collective failure to do more. Syed Purizap, London.
Mashhad, a tourist magnet in northeast Iran. Every year, some 30 million pilgrims from across the Muslim world travel to Mashhad to visit the holy shrine of Imam Reza, the 8th Shia Imam. But a few miles away from the shrine, there's a whole new world for tourists who would also like to enjoy natural resorts after a spiritual journey. Welcome to Kuh Sangi, a heaven at the heart of Mashhad, as described by this Iraqi family.
We come from Iraq. We visited the holy shrine of Imam Reza, and then I found about this amazing place called Kuh Sangi and came with my family to enjoy the scenery.
It's my second trip to Mashhad. The city offers you a whole traveling package that includes pilgrimage and recreation.
Kuh Sangi is one of a myriad of attractions in Mashhad. Natural resorts such as Shandi's and Chali Dara Valley, and recreational centers such as Water Waves Land and Iram Amusement Park are among the must-see places in Mashhad. The city is also home to 10,000 historical sites. Only 1,500 of those sites have so far been registered and developed for tourists.
One of the major attractions of Mashhad is its restaurants and street eateries. Mashhad is the city of foods. It has numerous restaurants serving a variety of local and international foods. Mashhad also has more than 680 parks, providing a chance for visitors to entertain themselves besides their pilgrimage.
Mashhad is also a hotspot for health tourism in the region. Only in 2021, over 24,000 health tourists visited the city, mainly from Iraq and Oman, earning the city roughly $48 million. Authorities in Mashhad say the potentials are countless, but so are the challenges. To foreign visitors, Mashhad is still a religious-only city, and many are not aware of its recreational capacities.
We at the municipality are trying to raise awareness of the attractions in Mashhad. One of those efforts is the launching of the English version of our website, which guides foreign travelers through the city online. We will soon launch the Arabic webpage as well.
Due to the large number of visitors throughout the year, Mashhad has one of the best-equipped public transport systems in the country. It has a growing subway network and bus rapid transit system, beside other transportation services, making it easy to access the desired tourist destinations in the city.
Known as the spiritual capital of Iran, Mashhad seems to offer more than a spiritual experience to visitors. With its spectacular natural resorts and growing number of recreational centers, Mashhad municipality plans to turn the city into a tourist hub in the region. Yusuf Jalali from the city of Mashhad.
This is IRIB English Radio. Website is www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
As the US Fed raises interest rates, dollar-denominated loans become an unsustainable burden to states around the globe. In this regard, we have prepared for you an article written by Philip and Mann titled, "The US Selfish War on Inflation Will Tip the World into Recession." Please stay with us to hear more about the story. Later in July, U.S. interest rates are expected to jump for a second time this year, and that's going to wreck any chance of a global recovery. The Federal Reserve could push its base rate up by as much as a full percentage point, ending 15 years of ultra-cheap money intended to promote growth. This jump to a range of 2.5% to 2.75% would take the cost of borrowing money in the U.S. to more than double the Bank of England's 1.25%. And yet, the Fed could just be taking a breather as it contemplates even higher rates. Though this column is not about the U.S., it is concerned with the terrible impact on Britain and countries across the world of America's selfish disregard when it decides to tackle high inflation with higher borrowing costs. Britain is already feeling the effects of the Fed's pledge to tackle inflation until it is defeated, come what may. U.S. officials claim higher interest rates in the U.S.
make it an attractive place for investors to store their money. But to take full advantage, investors must sell their own currency and buy dollars, sending the price of dollars rocketing higher. In July, the U.S. dollar increased in value against a basket of six major currencies to a 20-year high. The euro has slipped below parity with the dollar in the last few days. The pound, which has plunged by more than 10% this year to below $1.20, is losing value with every week that passes. In Japan, the central bank has come under huge pressure to act after the yen tumbled to its lowest level against the dollar since 1998. There are two important knock-on effects for those of Americans that live and work outside the U.S. The first is that goods and raw material priced in dollars are much more expensive, and most commodities are priced in dollars, including oil. Borrowing in dollars also becomes more expensive, and while getting a loan from a U.S. bank is beyond the average British household, companies do it all the time, and especially those in emerging economies where funds in their backyard can be in short supply. The Bank of England interest rate setter Catherine Mann recently said that her main motivation for wanting significant increases in the UK's lending rates was her fear that the widening gap with the dollar was pushing up import prices, and higher import prices meant higher inflation. If only she could persuade her colleagues on the bank's Monetary Policy Committee that the devaluation of the pound was a serious issue, maybe they would push up the bank's base rate in line with the Fed rate increases. After the Fed makes its move, more may join her. Until January this year, Britain's inflation surge was on the course to be short-lived. Now, it seems the Russian special operation in Ukraine and a splurge of untargeted handouts by the Biden administration during the coronavirus pandemic, which have served to push up prices in America, will keep inflation in the UK high into next year. Those governments that have borrowed in dollars face a double whammy. Not only will they need to raise domestic interest rates to limit the impact of import price rises, they will also face a massive jump in interest payments on their dollar borrowings. Emerging markets and many developing world countries will be broke when these extra costs are combined with a loss of tourism from the COVID pandemic. Sri Lanka has already gone bust, and many more could follow. Zambia's government borrowed heavily before the pandemic to become self-sufficient in electricity. It is a laudable aim, but has left the Central African state with a ratio of debt to national income much the same as France, about 110%. The problem for Zambia is not the same as for France, which pays an interest rate of 1.8% to finance its debts, measured by the yield on its 10-year bonds. The Zambian 10-year bond commands a rate of 27%. Now Zambia, like France and so many other countries, must borrow simply to live. To invest is to borrow more. There is no sign that the U.S. will change course. Joe Biden is in a panic about the midterm elections when fears of a spiraling inflation could favor the Republicans. This panic has spilled over to the Fed, which has adopted hysterical language to persuade consumers and businesses that higher rates are coming down the track and to curb their spending accordingly. Meanwhile, the price of oil rose on Monday, July 18th, after the U.S. President Joe Biden came away from talks in West Asia without an agreement on raising supply. Biden had hoped to secure a promise from Saudi Arabia to increase its output of oil, which could lead to an easing of global supply pressures. But Brent crude rose 2.6% to $103.88. After Saudi Arabia's foreign minister, Prince Faisal bin Farhan Al Saud, quelled speculation over an output increase. He said that officials at U.S.-Arab summit on Saturday, July 16th, did not discuss oil and that the OPEC oil cartel nations would continue to assess market conditions. Naeem Aslam, the chief market analyst at Ava Trade, said the message is that it is OPEC Plus that makes the oil supply decision and the cartel isn't remotely interested in what Biden is trying to achieve. He said OPEC Plus will continue to control oil supply and one country alone cannot determine the oil supply. At least that is the message that traders have taken from Biden's visit to Saudi Arabia. The increase in oil prices will keep up the pressure at the pumps, where drivers have faced record petrol and diesel prices. Prices have climbed so high that the government asked the Competition and Markets Authority to study the market, and its initial findings raised concerns over the margins made by refineries. Thus, the U.S. Fed knows inflation is a problem born of insufficient supply that only governments can take. But that doesn't look like stopping it from pushing the U.S. economy and everyone else's into recession.
Seven barometric pressure.
We come to you, and O God, knowing that thou art our only King.
You're listening to the program Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio with Brother Yasser Ibrahim.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد وعجل فرجهم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته dear listeners. Welcome to another episode of Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio with me, Brother Yasser Ibrahim. Mankind, or as the Quran puts it, many Adam, the children of Adam, have been given certain qualities, traits, and attributes that have not been given to any of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala's other creation, including the angels. And one of those traits is that a human being worships Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala out of free will in order to attain certain characteristics that will enable this person to get so close to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala that even the angels cannot come close to where that person is. And in this particular episode of Bookshelf, we would like to introduce one of these particular concepts that a human being needs to acquire. Yes, there is one that is natural. It is within the natural order of things that we are given it. But in order for a person to reach the peak of this particular concept, of this particular ethical trait, effort needs to be made in order for it to be inculcated within the soul and to be mixed with the person's existence such that it becomes a disposition, a trait, that whenever a person acts, this particular trait is along with that act. It is not separate from it. It is shown in that act. So inshallah, in our next segment, we will be introducing this book to our dear listeners. So please stay tuned.
From east to west, the light of His word does shine, for it issues from that central pole, central pole divine, which is neither to the east nor the west confined. And yet both east and west in its light unite.
Welcome back, dear listeners, to our program Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio with me, Brother Yasser Ibrahim. As we stated in our previous segment, that a human being the greatest of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala's creation, for a human being has the ability to manifest things within him that no other creature and no other creation of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has the ability to do. And one of those is the ethical concepts that human beings are able to attain, to make into attributes and dispositions that naturally flow from his essence and existence. And one of those particular attributes or qualities is the known as nobility or honor, or as we will see in the part that you will read to our dear brothers and sisters in our last segment, that the word that is used for this book cannot be translated into any other language, or the essence of the word cannot be translated, the word karama. So the book is titled Nobility in the Quran, the Farsi title being Karamat Dar Quran. It was, written, or it is a series of lectures rather, that the Grand Ayatollah Jawadi Amuli Hafizahullah, one of the great scholars of the contemporary era, gave over a period of 12 sessions. And obviously those lessons were then transcribed and written as the book form. So this book, Nobility in the Holy Quran, which was then translated from the Farsi to English by our dear friend, Sayyid Shiraz Agha, and was then obviously edited by another dear friend of mine, Sheikh Rizwan Rashid. The book was printed by Isra Foundation, or rather Isra Publications, in Canada in the year 2016. So what does this book aim to achieve? So this book basically says that this concept of nobility that the Quran acknowledges, it is based on a person's conscious attempt to attain the divine. And unfortunately, that because of the world that we live in, this particular concept and attribute and trait and the attaining of it is losing its appeal. And if someone actually wants to do it, it's actually very difficult for him to do so because of the increasing secular and ethically relativistic world that we live in. However, what this book tries to do is tries to show that there is a way to do it. And the book tries to firstly examine the topic by analyzing the verses of the Holy Quran and the traditions of the infallibles, alayhi salam. The author then tries to show the importance of instilling this trait of nobility within the human soul. And then he tries to give some general outlines and principles of how this nobility can be achieved and how this nobility can be attained by a human being. And obviously this is coming from a great scholar such as Ayatollah Jawadi Amuli, who is one of the leading scholars in all of the Islamic sciences, if you want to call it, in Irfan, in philosophy, in Kalam, obviously in Fiqh, in jurisprudence, and in the principles of jurisprudence. So inshallah, in our next segment, we'll be reading a portion of this book for the benefit of our dear listeners. So please stay tuned.
Among the sacred texts we have received to help us understand where we came from and where we are going as a human race are most rich in helping us find our direction. They narrate stories of our past. But where have they brought us? Where are their messages now? Are we the people of belief, or have we become the people of the boxes? Is there wisdom trapped in our bookshelves? Bookshelves, bookshelves, bookshelves.
Welcome back, dear listeners, to our program Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio. The book that we have introduced to our dear brothers and sisters is a book titled Nobility in the Quran, authored by Ayatollah Al-Uzma Jawadi Amuli Hafizahullah. The book was translated by Sayyid Shiraz Agha and edited by Sheikh Rizwan Rashid. It was printed in Canada in the year 2016. So obviously, as mentioned, the book deals with the concept of nobility, what it is, its importance, the importance of attaining it, and how it can be attained. But obviously, the first one, and in the first session, As we said, that this is a book that contains roughly 12 lectures and sessions that were delivered by Ayatollah Jawadi Amali Hafizahullah. So in the first session, obviously, a person wants to make the audience aware of what are we talking about. So the heading of this particular section of this particular session is titled, What is Nobility? Nobility is the very absence of baseness and vileness. The noble one, Kareem, is not to be confused with the eminent one, Kabir, or the exalted one, Azim. The meaning of the term Kareem probably does not have an exact equivalent in another language, which is with many of the Islamic concepts and principles. For example, the word Hajj itself does not have a very clear translation. The word pilgrimage does not do justice to the word Hajj. Anyway, therefore, if we wish to translate Kareem, we have no choice but to define it using a number of words so that collectively the meaning of the term can be grasped. Kareem, then, is the elevated soul of a person that is free from all types of baseness, of vileness, of wretchedness. God, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, considers the world, including all of its conventions, to be something that stands opposed to nobility and identifies it with the name dunya. This is because danawa, baseness, lowness, stands opposed to karama, or nobility. And dani, the base, stands opposed to kareem, the noble. We ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to enable us to attain this trait and this attribute of nobility, that our actions, you know, manifest this nobility that we have attained, and therefore become those who hopefully, inshallah, earn the pleasure of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, inshallah, until next time. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
That was the program Bookshelf with Brother Yasser Ibrahim on RIB English Radio.
From the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.